In his Memoirs of the Second World War, Chapter 20, Churchill speaks of the Soviet enigma.
The dismissal of Litvinov marked the end of an epoch. It retrograded the abandonment by the Kremlin of all faith in a security pact with the Western powers and in the possibility of organizing an Eastern Front against Germany. The German press comments at the time, though not necessarily accurate, are interesting. On May the 7th, the Frankfurter Zeitung was already sufficiently informed to state that Litvinov's resignation was extremely serious for the future of Anglo-French encirclement, and its probable meaning was that those in Russia concerned with the military burden resulting from it had called a halt to Litvinov. All this was true. But for an interval it was necessary that a veil of deceit should cover the immense transaction, and that even up to the latest moment the Soviet attitude should remain in doubt. Russia must have a move both ways. How else could she drive her bargain with the hated and dreaded Hitler? The Jew Litvinov was gone, and Hitler's dominant prejudice placated. From that moment, the German government ceased to define its foreign policy as anti-Bolshevism and turned its abuse upon the pluto-democracies. Newspaper articles assured the Soviets that the German Lebensraum did not encroach on Russian territory, that indeed it stopped short of the Russian frontier at all points. Consequently, there could be no cause of conflict between Russia and Germany unless the Soviets entered into encirclement engagements with England and France. The German ambassador, Count Schulenburg, who had been summoned to Berlin for lengthy consultations, returned to Moscow with an offer of an advantageous goods credit on a long-term basis. The movement on both sides was towards a compact. This violent and unnatural reversal of Russian policy was a transmogrification of which only totalitarian states are capable. The figure whom Stalin had now moved to the pulpit of Soviet foreign policy deserves some description, not available to the British and French governments at the time. Vyacheslav Molotov was a man of outstanding ability and cold-blooded ruthlessness. He had survived the fearful hazards and ordeals to which all the Bolshevik leaders had been subjected in the years of triumphant revolution. He had lived and thrived in a society where ever-varying intrigue was accompanied by the constant menace of personal liquidation. His cannonball head, black moustache, and comprehending eyes, his slab face, his verbal adroitness and imperturbable demeanor were appropriate manifestations of his qualities and skill. He was above all men fitted to be the agent and instrument of the policy of an incalculable machine. I have only met him on equal terms in parlies where sometimes a strain of humor appeared, or at banquets where he genially proposed a long succession of conventional and meaningless toasts. I have never seen a human being who more perfectly represented the modern conception of a robot. And yet, with all this, there was an apparently reasonable and keenly polished diplomacy. What he was to his inferiors, I cannot tell. What he was to the Japanese ambassador during the years when, after the Tehran conference, Stalin had promised to attack Japan once the German army was beaten, can be deduced from his recorded conversations. One delicate, searching, awkward interview after another was conducted with perfect poise, impenetrable purpose, and bland official correctitude. Never a chink was opened, never a needless jar was made. His smile of Siberian winter, his carefully measured and often wise words, his affable demeanor combined to make him the perfect agent of Soviet policy in a deadly world. Correspondence with him upon disputed matters was always useless, and if pushed far, ended in lies and insults. Only once did I seem to get a natural human reaction. This was in the spring of 1942, when he alighted in England on his way back from the United States. We had signed the Anglo-Soviet Treaty, and he was about to make his dangerous flight home. At the garden gate of Downing Street, which we used for secrecy, I gripped his arm. and we looked each other in the face. Suddenly he appeared deeply moved. Inside the image, there appeared the man. He responded with an equal pressure. Silently we wrung each other's hands. But then we were all together, and it was life or death to the lot. Certainly, in Molotov, the Soviet machine had found a capable and in many ways a characteristic representative. Always the faithful party man and communist disciple. How glad I am, at the end of my life, not to have had to endure the stresses which he had suffered. Better never be born. In the conduct of foreign affairs, Mazarin, Talleyrand, Metternich would welcome him to their company if there be another world to which Bolsheviks allow themselves to go.